Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And now historian Douglas Brinkley to do some double duty for us. He has advised President Obama on truly transformational presidents of the past. Can Obama have his greatest achievements in his second term? And we'll get Brinkley's take on politics and society after Sandy. Remember, he wrote a book about Hurricane Katrina. He teaches at Rice University. He was last here, as many of you remember, for his biography of Walter Cronkite earlier this year. And Professor Brinkley, welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thank you for having me on.
I saw you referred to in a recent New York Times article by Jody Cantor about these dinners the president had in his first term with an all-star lineup of historians, you and Doris Kearns Goodwin and Robert Dalek and Robert Caro and others. And the idea seemed to be that the president wanted your collective wisdom about the past to help him become not just a good but a transformational president. Would you say the president's aims are that high?
Well, I think largely he enjoys reading presidential biography, and we all have written them, so we would talk about our books. But yes, I mean, he enjoyed thinking about Theodore Roosevelt or Lyndon Johnson and what their circumstances were like and how they accomplished big things against a Congress that opposed them or against a public that didn't want to be moved in a particular direction. So we would talk about anything from TR and trust busting to FDR and his attempt to pack the Supreme Court to Lyndon Johnson passing voting rights acts in the 60s.
How did he do in this regard in his first term, in your opinion?
I think he's got the makings of it to be an extraordinary president. I mean, if we just simply get a pencil and mark all the successes that he's had, I mean, Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, if he can make it stick this term, will be one of the major social compacts with the American public. It'll be like FDR, Social Security, or Medicaid and Medicare of Lyndon Johnson's. And now it has Obama's name attached to it forever, meaning that health care issue is such a large one, and all progressive presidents since Theodore Roosevelt tried to do it, and only Obama got it through, although he still has to fight the next couple years to make sure it gets institutionalized and too many states don't break off from it. But the killing of Osama bin Laden, the number one terrorist not of our times, but maybe in U.S. history, the one individually our country most wanted to get, he got. Two Supreme Court justices put in. And I wrote in a Rolling Stone profile where I interviewed President Obama that he was also the progressive firewall. A lot of what he did and why people reelected him is, well, I will not do away with Planned Parenthood or PBS or NPR or Drill and Anwar or, you can make a long list. He stood up against a movement of our time that is decidedly anti-federal government, and he won. And so he's heading into a second term with his opposition, I think, esteem very low of the opposition.
Looking at history, is it harder for presidents to accomplish great things in their second terms?
You know, people say that. There's a whole mythology of the curse of the second term, and, you know, it depends where you look. If you want to look at Richard Nixon and George W. Bush, they both had awful second terms. But I tend to be more spirited and upbeat about it. There are always going to be ugly moments or dark moments in a second term. But, you know, Eisenhower had two terms, and in 1960, he could have beaten Nixon or Kennedy for a third term. The people believed in what he did, whether it was his diplomacy with Khrushchev, creating of NASA, dealing with the Suez crisis and the Hungarian Revolution astutely, giving the famous farewell address. We could dealing at Little Rock. Ronald Reagan's second term is what made him the so-called champion of winning the Cold War. It's not first-term Reagan, it's second-term Reagan, who did that great diplomacy with Gorbachev. And Bill Clinton, who we now laud as this great president and was so hot on the campaign trail in 2012, what we're celebrating about Bill Clinton is he balanced the budget and gave us a surplus, and that was all second-term Clinton. So I think it's a great opportunity for the president. I would much rather be a second-term president without the albatross of politics hanging around my neck so heavily than be a first-term president always having to juggle things to not offend certain portion of the electorate. But Obama needs to do something big and large and brave, and I think that might be being the international leader on climate change to hold a climate summit. And that's where Theodore Roosevelt's instructive. He held a, you know, started with Gifford Pinchot 100 years ago, wanting to have global conservation laws. Well, we're now in an era that climate's affecting everybody, and we need to talk about it as a global community, not just argue amongst our lobby groups in the United States about it.
Listeners, any questions for historian Douglas Brinkley? 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692, as we ask whether President Obama could become a transformative president in his second term. 212-433-9692. You know, you mentioned climate change as a possible big thing for the president to take on in the second term. Obviously, the debt and the fiscal cliff are coming up right now. And somehow I doubt fixing the national debt is the kind of transformation Barack Obama grew up dreaming about, as opposed to ending poverty or creating a sense of national unity and purpose after an era of polarization or things like that. What would you say about the content of his transformational dreams that he communicated to you at these dinners or in your Rolling Stone interview or anywhere else?
Well, it's a really interesting question. You know, we all have to play the hand that's dealt us. I'm sure he didn't think his big moment's going to be having to deal with the fiscal cliff. I think this so-called fiscal cliff issue is going to get cleared up pretty quickly, but it leads to a larger problem as we head into the second inaugural of Obama. How do we fix this economy? How do we get more jobs at play? And again, I think it's going to go back to this vision that the president had, and it got kind of hidden in his first term, of green jobs, of new energy, of, you know, if you really cut to the chase of all the thinking of the Obama White House, it's how do we get jobs through clean energy? Because if you can do that, you're moving America forward business-wise on a visionary front while you're also getting real jobs next year. It's a challenge to do it. But look, it was a challenge for Dwight Eisenhower to build the interstate highway system in the 1950s, the largest public works project in U.S. history. And he built the St. Lawrence Seaway, and it was a challenge. And all those dams out west that FDR built in the New Deal was a challenge. And going to the moon, when John F. Kennedy said it at Congress and then at my school, Rice University, 50 years ago, we're going to go to the moon within the decade. We did it. And the president somehow has to inject a can-doism on the notion of turning to alternative fuels, the clean energy revolution. It gets stuck a lot because the petroleum, big oil, is so opposed to that. It means loss of revenues in their mind, and it's probably the fiercest lobby group there is, but the president's going to have to stand up to that and find really constructive ways to start weaning America off fossil fuels.
And on the fiscal cliff, do you think the president's desire to be transformative will inform the way he approaches the negotiations that are now taking place? Because we hear this term grand bargain, right? President Obama and John Boehner almost struck a grand bargain in the summer of last year, and then it fell apart. And I wonder if he wants to be transformative in this regard, too, with respect to the debt over the next 10 years that creates room for more kinds of social spending and investments. And if so, do you think he gains or loses negotiating clout if he yearns for something like a grand bargain?
I think that he's got to go ahead. I wouldn't call it a grand bargain, but maybe a low-grade bargain. He's going to have to make some compromises right now and get this behind him. It's sort of, he's in a holding pattern right now. It's hard, you know, until his second inaugural, it's not really a second term. The holiday season's here, and this economic woe is right in front of us like a wall, and we all have to get over it. So he's going to have to do what it takes, but he will not compromise on the main principle of tax hikes have to go towards people making over $250,000 a year. That's what this campaign of 2012 was about. That's the one issue. If I'm a historian and I had to sum it up in a page, I'd be writing about that dominated the 2012 election, that issue, and Obama won on it. So why would he capitulate now under pressure? He's going to have to hold firm on that. And I think it's the Republicans who have just lost that are going to have to negotiate some of their key points away, not President Obama.
But then again, it's Obama as liberal firewall protecting against something rather than initiating something.
Well, I agree, and that's what I wrote about in my Rolling Stone piece. It's hard for him to get away from this liberal firewall. It's just hard. Every time he tries to move, that's what he's up against. But that's the tenor of our time. That's the blue-red divide. That's how close the 2000 election was in 2004. He's got a little bit of wind in his sail because so many Democratic senators also won, and there's no clear leader of the Republican Party. But as we see, there's an attempt to sabotage Susan Wright if she's nominated to be our Secretary of State. You're seeing McCain and Lindsey Graham right out of the gate just going for Obama's jugular on Benghazi. It does not look like it's going to be an easy next couple years. And by the time you get to 2015, everybody's going to be talking about the next presidential election. So he has a six-month window here to deal with this economic issue, to kind of get us on the right path, and to try to do some immigration reform and make another big attempt, which there looks like there may be able to be a grand bargain on that. And then he's going to have to forge forward on his own. You're seeing it on his trip right now to the Pacific region. There's an opportunity, perhaps, to create a new relationship between the United States and China, who's going to be our most important partner. And Obama is liked around the world. He's an international superstar. And as I mentioned on the climate issue, all countries want to talk about it. There's just a void of leadership. He's not going to be able to solve that, President Obama, but he might be able to ratchet up the connection between climate change and national security. The way Bloomberg did in New York with his business magazine, saying it's the climate stupid. It's a Republican mayor of our nation's largest city saying that. Many Republicans are recognizing that they can't hide the climate issue anymore. That happens to be the issue that I think President Obama can lead on and lead without Congress. And he's going to have to do that because he's only got Congress to deal with, I believe, for about 6 months. Do you realize every midterm election of a second term, meaning in 2014, all the opposition picks up congressional seats except for Bill Clinton in 96, picked up some in 98. But beyond that, so, you know, I'm not suggesting it'll be another Tea Party moment, but it's going to be hard in 2 years from now for the president. It's not going to get easier with Congress, so he's got to grapple with it this first 6 months.
Presidential historian Douglas Brinkley, as we ask if President Obama can become a transformational leader as he has aspired to in his second term in office. By the way, I know that Mayor Bloomberg would bristle at your characterization of him as a Republican mayor, and he'd say, no, I'm an independent mayor. But Jack in Tarrytown, you're on the air with Douglas Brinkley. Hello, Jack.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What are you thinking?
Okay, so how does President Obama compare to FDR on Social Security, and what would FDR say to Obama if he was around to give him a comment on how to handle Social Security?
Great question. Do you ever imagine a conversation like that, Professor Brinkley?
Well, we don't have the luxury as historians, because if we would be living in what-if world all the time instead of just the way the deal went down. But I think there's a lot to be learned by FDR, which is simply to just lead, to take, in the case of Social Security, which FDR obviously would want protected, to find ways to make it solvent forever, that it has to be, it's already become a birthright, Social Security. We just have to ensure that birthright. And it's tough right now when there's no money. It just, you know, we're looking at President Obama at a time when the country's broke, wanting him to do big, brave, and bold things. So he's going to, it may have to be that Social Security fixing of it might have to wait. Remember, George W. Bush tried it, made it a signature part of his reelection campaign in 2004, and wasn't really able to do anything with it.
John in Paramus, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Do you think Obama will cooperate a little bit more with Congress, or will he use executive order to get his proposals through?
I think there's an attempt right now with Boehner that he could do business with them. We've got about a six-month window. Let's see what happens. If they get over the fiscal cliff and all the American pats, you know, we pat both Obama and Congress on the backs for just stopping an unnecessary crisis. They then might be able to get in and tackle immigration reform. It could be bipartisan. But I think after that, there's not too much of a window because electoral politics is going to cut in, and then you will see President Obama using executive orders in a Theodore Roosevelt fashion where he has so much power at his disposal, and also becoming putting foreign affairs at the in trade relationships between the United States and other countries at the forefront of his agenda.
When John asks about cooperating with Congress, one of the weaknesses that many people see in the first term was his lack of being a schmoozer with the Republicans, you know, that he didn't invite people over to hang out and watch football games or play golf or whatever it is across the aisle so much. And people thought that one way that he would be transformative coming in was that he had the potential to be a postpartisan president. And, of course, the Republicans dug in right away and decided to be obstructionist on everything as a matter of strategy. But also he didn't have the social skills or those kind of inclinations. Is that also your assessment? And do you think that's something that he wants to change and that would help the country?
I buy into that a little bit. The president at times can seem intellectual, remote, and certainly a family man who would rather be with his wife and kids at night than schmoozing with legislators. I think there's no question about that. So it to a degree, it's a fair criticism. However, Mitch McConnell came in, and if you remember, Rush Limbaugh right out of the bat after the first Obama inaugural, they just said, let's not do business with this guy. That the strategy of the Republican Party was to just trash Obama and refuse to do business with them. This was not an era of Ronald Reagan having Tip O'Neill and Ted Kennedy to cut deals with. Right. It was a Republican Party that didn't want to do anything.
But then maybe you start inviting various leaders. Oh, you know, invite Paul Ryan and Eric Cantor and whoever it might be and say, the heck with what McConnell and Rush Limbaugh decided to do. I'm going to keep my relationships with these guys going, and then maybe it's going to pay off in the long run.
I think so. I think that's what has to happen now. So I'm in agreement with you.
Let's take another call. Rosemary in Princeton, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Brian. I just wanted to make a comment. I am a supporter of Obama's, and I like very much what your speaker is saying. However, I don't think we should lump together in his initial comments about Obama the Affordable Care Act and Medicare. You know, the Affordable Care Act, we have to be clear, was largely crafted by the insurance industry. And these are very, very different moments in history in terms of these issues.
So you're saying it doesn't belong on the same pedestal as Social Security or Medicare.
Exactly. And the other, I mean, I'm not saying it's not a you know, reasonable thing. I'm just saying that we have to understand what are the drivers of these things. These are not returns to programs that, you know, people have enjoyed and that have been, you know, colossuses in our history in terms of how people manage their lives. And secondarily, there is a lot of sort of slippery speech around reform of Social Security and Medicare, and no speech about what these wars, endless wars, cost us, and, you know, how these things are budgeted, and there isn't a lot of clarity. And so,
and Rosemary, I'm going to leave it there because our time is short. But what about that? Obamacare being remembered in the same breath as Social Security or Medicare 50 years from now, assuming it sticks and it really takes. You know, the difference to Rosemary is that it became this private sector-driven, Rube Goldberg contraption, unlike Social Security and Medicare, which are simply government programs.
Well, there's some truth to that. And, you know, look, we're short on time, so you have to condense a lot of things. Social Security of FDR was, I think, a much grander accomplishment, as was Medicare. Nevertheless, I think it's fair to put the Affordable Care Act into that kind of a basket, if you'd like, of presidents working to try to help middle class and America's less fortunate to achieve some kind of decent lifestyle, have some kind of safety net for themselves. So I agree with the caller, but I think the point's made that it's a major accomplishment, the Affordable Care Act.
And on the wars, I wonder if the jury is still out as to whether history is going to remember Obama as the president who was given the Nobel Peace Prize in anticipation of what he might do and then launched a surge in Afghanistan, or whether he's going to be remembered as the president who came in and ended two wars as a kind of peace president, or whether it's just too mixed to say any of either of those things.
I think he's going to come in like Dwight Eisenhower came in and ended the Korean War, that we're going to look at that he came in and ended the Iraq War and finished the mission in Afghanistan and then weaned us out of there. So if it's ostensibly the way it's looking now, he'll be a president who got us out of two wars and didn't get us into any new ones.
Briefly on Sandy, you wrote the book The Great Deluge about Hurricane Katrina. And through that lens, you saw President Obama's stature increase in the last days of the campaign due to his handling of the storm. Chris Christie's too, but not Romney's. What did Romney do wrong?
Romney did everything wrong, in my opinion. I mean, first off, he immediately should have embraced President Obama the way Governor Christie did and say that no matter what, I'm behind our president. We've got to pull together as a country now. He had to act like a statesperson, somebody who you would imagine as president. Instead, he seemed to grumble, stayed in Ohio, started doing a kind of photo ops with canned food. And then when asked about FEMA, which would be a logical question to ask somebody, he refused to talk and act like annoyers were announcers and broadcasters were annoying him by asking about previous comments that he didn't like FEMA. So, you know, he just looked like, and I think it was part of this strategy of not talking to the media the last few weeks of the campaign. Well, when a major event like Sandy hits, you want to hear what he would be doing. And it's a time to rally with the president, maybe go and be with Governor Christie, or at least sit in and let the public know how much you care and you're putting politics on freeze. He tried to have it both ways, use it as spending time in Ohio trying to but yet not answering any questions about Sandy.
Hard to do in the last few days, though, before the election, where you want to unseat the guy. And we have seen President Obama, Governor Cuomo, and Governor Christie, and Mayor Bloomberg all rise in popularity, even spike in popularity in Christie's case. A new poll today has his approval rating up 20 points among Democrats in the state. And this is also different from Mayor Nagin, Governor Blanco, and President Bush after Katrina. Is it that they learned certain lessons?
I think they did. I have nothing but admiration for Governor Chris Christie. He's done a remarkable job because a lot of leadership in these crises is being there, just being on the ground, talking with empathy and emotion about the land and the state you love, working hard to get money pried from the federal government, working the phones nonstop. He's done all of it. And I think he's become a folk hero, Governor Christie, over this. Now, there's some troubled times ahead when people aren't getting their insurance payments and they realize that they're not getting the car they thought they had, and then the debris turns to mold in the basement and somebody gets sick. And there are many, many plaguing problems to come. But at this moment in time, you'd have to give Governor Christie a standing ovation.
Historian Douglas Brinkley from Rice University. Great conversation. Thank you so much for giving us the time today, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you and your listeners.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll check in with Long Beach and Oceanside and see how Thanksgiving is shaping up there after Sandy. And then we'll have a pre-Thanksgiving call-in on the conversations you're looking forward to tomorrow and the ones that you're dreading. So think about those and stay with us.